Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times. I'll be your host today on behalf of the professional committee. Before I introduce our guest, let me just do a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, please, everybody, turn off your phones now, or at least put them on mute. As you can see, we now are videoing all of our speeches. We put them up on YouTube. You have connections now on the FCC website. But it's really hard to hear somebody if you have a beep, 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 beep in the middle of that really key quote that everybody wants to double check afterwards. So please turn off your phones now. Next, I'd like to mention our next speaker. That'll be on Wednesday. It's Sir Vernon Ellis. He's the chairman of the British Council with operations in practically every country. They try to project soft power, as it's often called. And he'll be here to speak to us based on his experience both at running the British Council and having run Accenture, the consulting firm, before that. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. Frank Lavin is here to talk about exports. He's somebody who really knows that issue. He's somebody who really knows U.S.-China relations. He was, from 2005 to 2007, the Undersecretary for International Trade at the Commerce Department. And for those of you who don't follow the labyrinth of the U.S. bureaucracy, the Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade and the United States Trade Representative are really the two people in many ways who run American trade policy. He's also served as ambassador to Singapore and in a variety of other political appointee positions. With that, I give you Frank Lavin. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Tara. Thank you, Francis, for hosting me here today. Delighted to be back at the FCC. Thank you, everybody, for coming and spending some of your afternoon in this discussion. It's a subject I suspect everybody in this room covers extensively throughout the course of their professional career, but talk about U.S.-China relations, which is the subject of enormous academic and journalistic political scrutiny, but also to talk about that relations in our particular moment against a backdrop of protracted Chinese overperformance and at least several years of U.S. Economic underperformance, which I think just highlights a trend that's been going on for some time. But it does pose challenges, I think, to both China and the U.S. So what I want to do today is just put some items on the table, and I'm told that the audience here has a propensity for asking questions as well, so we'll leave time for questions at the end. I really have five general points in my remarks. One, this might be bad news for the headline writers, but I think relations are basically good. I take a positive view of where we are today. That's point number one. Two is a new era. What does this moment mean for those relations? Three is the paradox of consequentialism. For the limits of the Chinese system, where I think is kind of a, not quite a danger area, but an area of concern. And five, close up with potential landmines or potential problems. And look, what I don't want to do is go through a litany of the issues. So this isn't sort of the encyclopedia presentation about where do we stand on various trade issues and intellectual property rights and Tibet and Taiwan arms sales. I'm certainly happy to get into those questions, but I want to keep it more thematic, more conceptual. So first talk about why relations are basically pretty good. Well, interestingly, when I look at U.S. and Chinese foreign policy, neither country has a long foreign policy tradition, a long geopolitical tradition. U.S. came into the world stage only since World War II, thrust onto it by the Cold War. And China, throughout China's history, foreign policy almost without exception was simply border state management. I mean, occasionally issue emerged, and certainly in the modern era, many issues emerged. But it's a country that overwhelmingly was internally focused, not surprisingly, for a massive continental power. But both countries, I would say, have leadership that tends to be very much national interest focused. Neither country subscribes to a philosophy which intrinsically threatens the others. And if we look in the modern era, the 40 years or so since relations began, I think you'd say that neither country has sought to wrong foot the others. Neither country went out of its way to disadvantage the others, although either country might be in a mode to promote its own self-interest. So nobody's seeking to put sand in someone else's rice bowl. And not to dismiss the problems in front of us, there's some significant ones, but most of the issues in front of us, I think, fall well within the range of foreign policy issues that countries of this size would encounter. The two foundational elements of U.S.-China policy for these 40 years have been a policy of engagement, which was quite controversial when first promulgated by Nixon and then Kissinger, and even when Carter formally opened up relations was criticized. But engagement, the point is, no matter how bad relations are, no matter what problems there might be, you've got to keep diplomacy going. And secondly, respect for China's one China policy. And those have been two foundational elements. And they've held up, I think, fairly strongly across eight presidents, both political parties, and a range of political philosophies and different congressional leadership and so forth. So I think it's important to start with that positive point, because since we're so focused on today's problems, today's headlines, you know, to think that there's a fair amount of good news in that relationship, despite the differences in language, culture, political systems, level of development, and so forth, it's a good starting point. Now, what is this new era? Well, this new era is consequential China, or serious China. That China, for the first time ever, plays a consequential role in world affairs. So I think you'd say its share of world economy is the largest it's ever been, its share of military capabilities is the largest it's ever been, share of university graduates, the largest it's ever been. So what it says and what it does matters increasingly. And this is a new role for China. It's a new role for the United States and the rest of the world as well. In my view, this rise of China is the most significant development in international relations since the end of the Cold War. And it's really going to be the defining attribute, I think, of the 21st century. The paradox of consequentialism is this. Even as China's emerged from isolation over 40 years, and it's moved toward market economics, and it's joined the United Nations, and it's joined the WTO, and it's moved toward participating in the international community the way other nations have as well, the paradox is there's more and more sensitivity and more concern about the role it plays. So you'd think that even though in sort of absolute terms, China's behavior has improved dramatically over 40 years. I look primarily at the trade and economic issues, as Keith alluded to. Nonetheless, there's some strong criticism in some quarters. I would explain it in trade terms something like this. If we went back 30 or 40 years into China-U.S. trade policy, and we asked what percent of Chinese trade policies would we accept as normal policies that are adopted by most of the members of the community of nations, I think if you went back 30 years, you'd say a very, very small amount, maybe 10%. China at the time didn't have posted tariff rates. You could go to different ports in China and you'd be quoted different rates. You could ask to see the list, the posting, and you'd be told we can't show that to you. You just sort of like Nathan Detroit, I've removed them all for good luck, but I remember what they are and this is what your number is. So China would not get a high mark a few decades ago for its adherence to international trade norms. If you ask about that number today, I think most people would say, look, China probably deserves a pretty high mark. WTO membership generally successful, generally adhering to its international commitments. There's always issues, always problems. There's enormous problems with international property rights. There's criticisms that can be made of sort of mercantilist economic policies, but in terms of commitment to international trade obligations, I think you'd say generally it's taking those pretty seriously. But so what would explain though for criticism? Well, because 30 years ago China's trade policy didn't matter. It didn't set global prices. It didn't affect global competition. It didn't affect companies in the U.S. or Europe. Now, if it behaves in a way that's considered not keeping with the norms, it has that global ripple effect. So this is the paradox, that even as China improves, it subjects itself to more criticism. The main point I wanted to share today are some of the limits I see in the Chinese system that I think pose a challenge for Chinese political decision making. And I think the core of the problem is that in foreign policy, long-term success is driven by external equilibrium, but policy decisions are driven by an internal impetus. So China's long-term foreign policy goals are to achieve a set of objectives peacefully, but the constraints and determinants of the policies that shape those outcomes are determined in large respects by domestic political constraints or bureaucratic constraints. Now, I have to say many countries have that, and the United States certainly has that element as well, but we might see it more strongly in China than other countries. For example, what would explain a ongoing, a persistent China tilt toward North Korea? What would explain a persistent desire of China to cultivate North Korea, even to the point of alienating and degrading positive relations with South Korea? So when we saw certain incidents over the last 2 years, incidents at sea, clashes between North Korea and South Korea, shelling of the islands, sinking of the South Korean boat, and we looked at China's response, I think from a foreign policy perspective, we'd say China is not handling this in its own best self-interest. It behooves itself to take a more balanced view so that it can show some sympathy to South Korea's position without antagonizing North Korea. But why would it remain silent or slow in offering condolences? Why would it appear to have that North Korean tilt? Well, to my mind, there's a good answer to that. It's not a foreign policy answer, but it's a domestic policy answer, that the Korean War still stands as iconic in Chinese government, in Chinese leadership. And to take any kind of public position which appears to diminish China's role or China's relationship with North Korea is an unpatriotic type statement. So Chinese government leadership have very limited flexibility in adjusting that tilt. So they are betting on the wrong pony, you could say, but it just shows you one of the very powerful constraints in the Chinese system. We had the remarks by Xi Jinping to the PLA last year in which he raised the topic of the Korean War, and he said it was a great and just war for safeguarding peace and resisting aggression. And he went on to praise the PLA actions as a great victory in the pursuit of world peace and human progress. And most people would say, look, even if you're coming from a Beijing perspective, that does strike one as a little bit over the top. So what would put you in that kind of corner? So domestic politics and bureaucratic constraints are an important element of foreign policy formulation. Another constraint in foreign policy formulation is the primacy of internal cohesion, that there's really one question in the job interview in China as you go through the system. And this job interview lasts 50 years, right, through your entire career. So it certainly perplexes the Chinese when they take a look at the United States and they say, your job interviews for top positions seem to last maybe 50 weeks or maybe 50 days, but ours last 50 years. But there's really one core question in the job interview. Are you one of us? Are you part of the team? Can we count on you? Right. And internal cohesion assumes a central position in government decision making. Now look, there's all sorts of value and strength in that type of arrangement, but there are certainly limitations as well, because it means you don't necessarily get the range of views or the range of actions that might lead you to a better outcome. But it does mean you have a group of people at the top who get along very well together and can live with each other's differences and work through these differences very effectively. But that takes me to a third constraint, which is tied to the previous point of cohesion, and that's a silo government. So when we look at most of the Western governments, and I would say even Japan, in my view, Beijing has much more of a silo-type system where different ministries do certain things without necessarily a high degree of interagency coordination or without necessarily looking at broader or long-term national interest. And we saw this dramatically in the areas I worked in trade issues, but we see this in other areas as well. I would point to the these factors, for example, as contributing factors to some of the decisions made by the National Rail Ministry. And I'm not talking about the safety record. That's a separate set of issues. But I'm talking about just some very fundamental questions about how do you evaluate cost and benefit of a national high-speed rail line? How many kilometers of high-speed rail should China have? What capacity should they have on high-speed rail? And what is the marginal cost and marginal benefit of that last track? And who makes those decisions? So did this go through some kind of rational planning process to say, yes, this is what our government needs, this is what our country needs, and this is the right amount of money to spend for it, and this is the kind of benefit we're going to get out of it? If you'd said we're not going to do this at all, but we're going to just upgrade our traditional system, but we can add more capacity, would that have been better? In what ways would that have been better or worse? So just the kind of what we would hope normal planning process, decision-making process the government should go to before allocating that kind of money, I think is highly attenuated in China. Now, by the way, I would be the first to say, guess what, it's highly attenuated in the United States as well. And you have some of the same issues in the United States where you have rent seekers and interest groups and so forth that are just trying to push their point, no doubt. But this struck me as an extensive amount of money to spend without a high degree of scrutiny as to in what ways China needed this kind of grid and what way should it work. And I come without a background in surface transportation issues. It was just striking to me that no other continental nation in history has said we're going to use high-speed rail as a transportation mode. You've got very short segments in Japan and in France and a few other places where people do use high-speed rail, but Brazil or Canada or the United States or Russia, no other continental country has said, yes, this is the model we're going to use. So China is either a lot smarter than everybody else, or it has a government which operates on a silo basis. And the fellows in different, and we know this is what we call BOGSAT management. BOGSAT standing for a bunch of guys sitting around a table. But we get a sense, and you know, I've been in the cabinet meetings in my country, and you get a sense of how it works, which is you go ahead with your project, I go ahead with my project. That's how it works. I remember very well discussing with a senior Chinese official in the agricultural ministry in Geneva about WTO proposals and about how helpful these would be to China. And China's leading export nation in the world, so anything that reduces trade barriers is very helpful to Chinese economy. And this was built around some reduction in cotton subsidies as well. And so it was a little bit of medicine for the agriculture ministry to take. And he said, but it's a huge net advantage for China. And the fellow said, yes, of course you're right. But listen, you know what? I'm not paid to safeguard China's GDP or export growth. That's not my job. My job is to deal with about 400,000 cotton farmers. And that's who I answer to. And I can tell you, they are not going to like this idea. So in my view, this idea is dead. So yeah, you can always take it up someplace and get someone else to say it's still alive. But for me, it's not alive. So that was a good. Now, by the way, you'd have somewhat the same response in the United States. So it's not radically different. Let me make another point about limitations in the Chinese system. One other one I think we should be aware of is the transition that took place with the departure of Deng Xiaoping, the transition from personality-led system to a bureaucratic-led system. Classical international relations theory would teach us that an ascendant power should avoid forcing any issue. If the country is in the uptick economically, time is on its side. So it should defer any particular issue because it'll have a stronger position in the years to come. And indeed, that philosophy was very much crystallized in Deng Xiaoping's view of China's role in the world when he talked about Taoguang Yanghui. Said, you know, there's no sense getting in front of an issue, right? So we bide our time. We hide our strengths, we bide our time, right? And that seemed to me to be very consistent with China's own interests. So I thought he was a wise guy. But we realize now that it took someone of a dominant political personality to be able to push back against the system, because there's a natural locomotion that takes place in any kind of political system where there needs to be an assertion, right? An assertion of strength, an assertion of self, an assertion of national identity. And it's very tough to constrain that, particularly when you're in ascendant power. And I think when you have a proud and successful civilization like China, I think it's a very natural human emotion. So we saw a lot of incidents over the last 2 or 3 years in the South China Sea, or the Chinese fishing boat hitting the Japanese Coast Guard cutter, or the some of the statements in the South China Sea that were reasonably strong assertions. And in terms of how they played in Chinese domestic policy, it might have been a very positive response. But did they help China towards its goals? Is China now have greater currency and greater respect in Southeast Asia, or does it have greater wherewithal with the Japanese foreign ministry than it had before these incidents? I'd say this was a backwards movement, not a forward movement for Chinese foreign policy. So that transition from dominant personality to bureaucratic management, I think, is also a constraint. And I think one other point, which is not a formal government point, but I think just belongs in this discussion about constraints on government policy in China, that I just throw out to the body here for consideration, is the emergence of the internet in China. And it ties into some of these previous points, because I think overwhelmingly it's a healthy development, but it's not a balanced development. So on some issues, direct criticism or open criticism of government policy is prohibited. So then you're left only with sort of emotional range of pro-government activities. And it's difficult to balance that emotionalism or even chauvinism with a counter-argument. And I think we saw that with the Japanese fishing boat issue. We've seen that with other issues as well, where people jump in and the whole debate is skewed because of the lack of balance in the internet system. Let me wrap up with landmines, and I'll take it back to the optimism. Look, I think China and the U.S. face twin challenges in foreign policy management. My advice to friends in China is that China probably needs to think more about how to manage this new international role by showing restraint or by showing subtlety. And this is probably the difference between a mature great power and a less mature power. I think that's very difficult to do given China's domestic political environment and some of the other constraints I mentioned. But I think U.S. also has a challenge, that U.S. also has to show flexibility and goodwill in trying to work with China. So the landmine, the biggest mistake to my mind that China could make would be to view foreign policy only as a tool of domestic policy, or the only an assertion of policy is the equivalent of carrying out a policy, because an assertion of a point of view is not the same as adoption of policies that help you reach your objectives. But the U.S. is also potentially capable of making mistakes in this regard as well, that it views China through a very deterministic lens, that China's economic rise inevitably means hostility. Because I think if we look at Sino-American relations, it's a mosaic. There are 1,000 policies and initiatives and gestures and meetings and negotiations. So its relations aren't predetermined by GDP growth rate. And I think we have to say, given the size and complexities of these two governments, there are going to be differences, and there's certainly going to be points of friction. But there's enormous progress in the relationship. And so I'll close on the same note of optimism. If there's as much positive movement in the next 40 years as there has been in the last 40 years, then leaders of both countries need to be congratulated for their statesmanship. So thank you very much, Keith and Tara and Francis, for having me here. We're very happy to answer questions. Can I come up? Thank you. Thank you.
Please stay there. Well, thank you very much. That was broad, far beyond trade. Frank has been active on security policy and succession administrations as well, and so it was very interesting to hear that. Who would like to throw out the first question? Back here, please. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, Frank. Robert Greaves with Hamilton Advisors. Just in Beijing the last couple of days, hearing a lot about from senior business leaders and government officials about how the U.S. has blotted its economic playbook, monetary fiscal policy not working well, and the rise of the renminbi as a reserve current. And it's a very popular idea in Beijing, like right now. A lot of people agitating for it over time. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, and particularly how the U.S. is going to have to manage this process.
Yeah, you're right, Bob. I think we're at a moment that the cumulative effect of this long-term growth in China combined with the problems in the U.S. and Europe contribute to that kind of environment where I would say the a typical view of a senior person in Beijing is we've cracked the code. We figured it out. You guys in the West had elements of the code. You figured some things out. Market economics, competition, pricing mechanisms, that's great. That's terrific. We respect that. But you got a lot of things wrong, too. And so what we've got is an improved version. We're your strengths without your weaknesses. Well, that's a subjective comment, of course. Just put me down as skeptical. But, you know, when the sun is shining and when it's been shining for quite a while, human nature is such that people believe it's going to be sunny every day. So you do have that. And you can gravitate even towards hubris if it goes on too long. I don't think it's healthy for Beijing, not healthy for the rest of the world either. I mean, you have to be careful. China's got its share of problems. One problem it doesn't have is fiscal mismanagement, which the U.S. has and Europe has. But it's got any other problem you could find. So I think I would offer a word of friendly caution, but I think it's going to complicate the policy debate for the near term. And I can remember presentations in China. I went to the Beijing Higher Party School before the turmoil and to present to them why subsidized bank loans were bad for China, which I believe just is it's just bad for them. It's bad for us too, because we in the U.S. have to live with subsidized products, and then we have countervailing duties, and it ripples through the world economy. But it was bad for China over the long run to have subsidies from banks. Non-market determined bank rates go to certain industries that they wouldn't then have market determined companies. So I thought I was making a reasonable point that I'd get an audience. But I'll tell you, before you could even kind of go through this point and go through the presentation, the entire view of the entire room was, what's your economy growing at? And what's our economy growing at? And you came here to tell me that I'm doing something wrong? Please go ahead with your presentation. So there was no appetite for listening or learning or building, which is unfortunate. I mean, you think there's a lot going right in China. In fact, the good news to bad news ratio in China might be the best of any time in Chinese history. But having said that, I think it's very difficult in any political system to say, now that we've got things going the right way, let's use our strengths, let's use our resources to try to fix some structural problems. What you tend to do, and we know this from Washington, what you tend to do is just the opposite. Everything's going the right way, so I don't have to change anything, right? And that's unfortunate for China, because I think you'd see that rate of growth taper off. But that's certainly where they are. I think you've captured it well.
Thanks. Francis?
Yeah, this may be one of those questions where trade and security somehow fall into each other. But I'm wondering whether you have a view on how China has been handling this whole affair in Libya. And some people feel that it has actually shot itself in the foot in terms of not only dealing with Libya, but with some other countries as well, especially as it needs a lot of commodities from different parts of what used to be called the Third World.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I mentioned in my closing remarks subtlety and restraint. And maybe I should have added a third point, which is information flow. And one of the problems I see, one of the constraints in Chinese government decision making is bad news doesn't move up quickly. And you just need that in government. You need to be made aware of what is the worst thing happening right now, what's the downside, and then what can we do about it, so to contain a problem. And for all sorts of reasons, some of which are articulated, the system militates against rapid transmission of deteriorating situation. I think that's more of a personal, bureaucratic kind of constraint, that nobody wants to be the messenger. The trouble is then you can't adjust course, you can't make a course correction. And so you can be sure, if you looked at Chinese foreign ministry cables about what's going on and what should we be doing, that far, far beyond a point where most people in this room would view Gaddafi as a worthy interlocutor, that the cables are going back from Tripoli to Beijing saying, we're doing better every day with this guy. And we've got a good thing going and we need to keep building on it. And their ability to adjust, I think, is just more limited than many other governments. So that was my takeaway from it.
But in some sense, it may go beyond that. I mean, what we see is when they finally came, their role in the United Nations, where they could have played a different role than what they did. And also where you see that when they finally came to a deal with the provisional government, or whatever you want to call it today in Libya, the first thing they wanted to know was that this government would adhere to the one China policy. And that was one of its main concerns in terms of coming to an arrangement.
But Francis, aren't you endorsing my view of saying unit cohesion is number one? To say, you know, there's no, it was almost kind of a joke, which I don't think is accurate, but it was almost a joke saying there's no such thing as foreign policy. There's only the foreign dimension of domestic policy. So if I'm sent as the special envoy to Tripoli to go figure out what these guys want, and I've got to report back, the first question I'm going to get asked when I come back is, where are they on one China? Right? And so I've got to be able to respond to that. So it's governed by these domestic political requirements.
So what are the implications of this for China dealing with other countries, particularly in that part of the world?
I think it is a constraint that their primary mechanism of engagement with other countries is on their own terms, not the other country's terms. And I think we'd say a fundamental law of diplomacy is to try to understand where the other person is trying to go, and then try to articulate your goals and see what kind of a convergence or overlap you can nurture out of that discussion. But if you don't have that kind of flexibility, it's very tough to do.
Well, and certainly, I guess, many of the problems in Darfur disappeared and the whole region went off the international radar the moment Chad switched diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing, and Beijing stopped supporting the rebel militia in
yeah.
Darfur.
Yeah.
But just change the subject a little bit. You used to run the anti-dumping and anti-subsidy apparatus when you were the undersecretary for international trade. What is your take on Wen Jiabao's demand that the European Union grant market economy status to China, almost seeming to link it to Chinese purchases of European debt?
Well, I'd sort of go back to say that strikes me as a statement that is designed overwhelmingly for domestic consumption, not a statement that's designed for approval in Brussels. And if nothing else, even if you thought you could finesse that and link those two issues, you would want to do so privately and subtly, not publicly and explicitly. So that tells me that, they weren't going to, at the end of the day, write a check. So they said, I'm not going to put money behind it. Which, you know, look, I'm certainly sympathetic to that point of view, so I can't criticize them. Nobody here is heaving up on European sovereign bonds either, right? So we're all in agreement with Wen Jiabao, right? So the point is, but if you know up the starting point, we're not going to get into this initiative, then I think you'd say, let me at least try to communicate a domestic political message on this, which is the Europeans have been fundamentally unfair to us, and if they think about changing that balance, we might think about pushing them.
Okay. Tara?
You've been speaking about China's engagement with the rest of the world, but what would be your report card for how the U.S. and the U.S. administration is engaging with China? We have senators who are speaking out against the currency, companies who are upset about the what they call a non-level playing field in China.
Yeah.
Do you think that the U.S. needs to rethink how it speaks to China and Chinese officials?
Well, Terry, you put your finger on a very important point, which is, look, the U.S. has an open system, and anybody can say anything they want for any reason, not necessarily speaking for the government, but you can be an elected public official and you can articulate your views, and certainly you can be in the private sector and say whatever you like. And in the early days, this was enormously confounding for the Chinese, and they would literally call you up and say, you've got this backbencher in the other party who has said something critical about us, and you tell him to shut up. And we say, you know, my friends, you should see what he says about us. See, he doesn't like my president. He doesn't like your president. So, you know, what to do? And I remember when. Are we on the record here?
Yes, and yeah, we're okay. On YouTube too.
I'll have to take this anecdote down a notch. Li Denghui is going to speak at his alma mater at Cornell University, right, to receive an honorary degree and speak there. And this is deeply irritating to the Chinese government, right, even though he's coming in an unofficial capacity, he's doing it, but they are very bothered by this. And we explained to him, you know, nobody in the U.S. government is receiving him, he's not here as an official guest, he's allowed to come and go, and he's speaking at his university, and that's, you know, consistent with U.S. law. Then he flies in to go to Ithaca, he flies into Syracuse, and the mayor of Syracuse says, I will greet Li Denghui. And the Chinese come back and say, aha, now you have broken the rules, because now you have a government official, formally greeting. And you have to say, listen, you know, this fellow isn't paid by us. I mean, he's just the mayor, and he does whatever the hell the mayor wants to do. And there's nothing. Well, they proposed that, you know, we sort of take direct action against the mayor. We said, you know, there's nothing, I mean, legally, the mayor's doing what the mayor wants to do, and there's nothing to be done about it. I mean, the point is, this is a long answer to Tara's question, but if you go back 10 or 20 years, I think there was very limited understanding about how an open system worked. I think there's much greater understanding now about it, and that, as I tried to make clear in my remarks, we certainly have people in the United States who use China as a political football as well, and will make or articulate some kind of China point of view when it's not necessarily germane, but it placates a domestic constituency. You know, because when China passed Japan and become the world's second largest economy, I think in some respects China becomes then the focal point for projecting, when Americans project economic uncertainty or economic fears, they'll criticize China as having not, you know, supposedly been unfair or violating a law or something of that nature. So it assumes this role in sort of American political lexicon, which to my mind isn't always accurate. But I think the Chinese aren't fussed by what a backbencher says or what a business person says, but they're very concerned about what the government says. By the way, I'd give the current administration good marks. I think relations are an even keel. So there might be surprising to people say, no, I come from a different political party, but I think they've taken the relationship very professionally. It's not a huntsman for president point either, so.
Okay, who next? While you're thinking about it, why don't we, we do have one over here, I'm sorry, I didn't see that.
Thank you. Jonathan Shaw, barrister. I'm interested in your views on what's happening in the Indian Ocean in terms of China's attempt to get more military-based naval bases and take on India in the region. How does that affect the United States, if at all, assuming China gets hegemony there?
Yeah. Look, I think China is at a period of long-term geopolitical ascendancy, and it's several decades of outperformance in terms of economic growth have started the process of translating into substantial military buildup as well, and there's a political dimension to this. What China wants and seeks is still being defined, right? But it's on the uptick. So the short answer is it envisions itself playing a broader political military role in the region than it historically has. All right, and I think on one level we should expect this because it's got more of a voice. On the other hand, the United States has substantial interests in the region as well. The United States has a number of treaty allies in the region, and it's been the United States security architecture that has, by and large, kept peace in the region since the end of the war. Two hot wars in Vietnam and Korea, but by and large. Now, I know you're talking about the Indian Ocean, but I simply want to say the same points, I think, applied, that you're going to see China seeking a greater role than ever before. This is a secondary theater for China, not a primary theater, but by the same token, it's starting from a lower base. And I think you're going to see that be potentially, if mishandled, that could be an area of concern for other countries in the region. So this is back to the paradox of consequentialism. You know, be careful about simple assertions of power, assertions of strength, because what can happen is you encourage other powers to work more closely together and you end up being more, your net political position is weaker as a result.
Okay, one more question here and then we have to wrap up.
Rachel Cartland, formerly a Hong Kong civil servant. I just want to ask quickly about the US. You know, I think that a lot of people looking from the outside, for the whole duration really of the Obama presidency, it really looks like a government that is totally, utterly bogged down and can't make meaningful progress on big issues at all.
It's just a small EU, isn't it?
Do you think that's
come
that's
on, that was a good line. I want a response here from this audience.
Do you think that's fair? And if it's true, do you think whose fault is it? Is it Obama's own fault? Is it the fault, the dark side of the Constitution, or is it a more confrontational culture with a nasty dose of racism hidden in there somewhere?
By the way, I don't think the EU point I made was made as a flip point, because it's directly related to your question to say, guess what? You've got a larger polity which deeper and longer constitutional structures has bogged down, if not more bogged down. So is it anti-Belgian racism that is undercutting President Rompuy? Or are there just structural problems in some key economies where people are just spending a lot more money than they're taking in? And the political discipline to come to terms with that doesn't exist in the system, or the system doesn't easily allow it. Now, I would say the challenges in Europe and U.S. are pretty similar, because the fundamental problem in the U.S. is you've got three or four structural programs where the money going out is just vastly outpacing the money coming in, and you can't come to terms with that. Now, if you overlay that, you have decline in business confidence, consumer confidence, but you've got the same thing in Europe. So it's a challenge, I think, for all the Western democracies about can you have discipline in the system, in a political system. And all of these programs might have made sense, or some part of them might have made sense, they might have been well-founded. But to say if the numbers don't line up, over time you're going to end up in a bad situation. So if Greece is admitted to the European Union, and at the time it's admitted, it's not adhering to the budget requirements, the deficit requirements. Everybody sort of glosses over this at the time, but they say, well, let's call the unfunded pension obligations, we'll just call them something else, and we'll just get Greece in. If we're able to do, what are we saying? We're saying there's not integrity in the system. If the United States says we're going to have the most expensive health care program ever adopted, but we're going to contend this actually saves money, there's not integrity in that system, right? And I mean, if you can pay a price for that. So I think it's overwhelmingly a fiscal problem in both societies. I think the fiscal problem is brought about because of institutional integrity issues. I think it requires enormous political leadership to get back on track. I don't see it in any of these polities, I have to say. I'm not optimistic about discipline in these societies.
Sorry, I don't want to prolong it, but surely there must be like a very profound difference, because after all, the EU is still a sort of experiment, a work in progress, in a single currency and all this sort of thing. Whereas the US has had a working constitution for more than 200 years. And if you look back and see what Roosevelt did, like it or not, it was much more dynamic.
I'll give you the short answer. It doesn't make sense to have this discussion about who was first or who was worst. Both parties are guilty, in my view. I mean, I guess the Americans might say, well, Greece has had a few thousand years to get this democracy down pat, you know, and they didn't seem to quite master it. But look, it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, Greece has just made a hash of its fiscal situation. The rest of the EU were enablers. They got the biggest alcoholic in the bar, and they said, we'll just give you one more drink, right? So everybody piled in and made it worse. But I said, the U.S. is no better. And nobody in the U.S. should feel proud that we've got the fiscal mess we've got on our hands, right? And it's cumulative. It takes place over years and years and years. And I don't even particularly blame or fault the people at initiation, because at initiation, when you looked at the numbers, it was sort of plausible. I mean, this is the point about Franklin Roosevelt introduced Social Security that gives you a payout at age 65 when the average lifespan is 62. So you say, all right, this is why he's a great president, right? I mean, the math worked for him, and the math doesn't work now. So it's not something evil or sinister. I don't ascribe, you know, evil motives to people of different political views. So it's just the numbers don't line up, you know, and it's going to require a lot of discipline to get the numbers to line up. And Europe's got a lot to do, and the U.S. has got a lot to do.
So it's a sort of rich people's sickness all around the world.
Well, here, I think you make a terrific point. This is overwhelmingly a crisis brought about by elites. This was the best and the brightest. I mean, if you say who put together the EMU and who was against the EMU, you know, there's a clear difference in education level, affluence, and so forth. But if you look at U.S. spending in the last few years and you say who wanted to spend more, I mean, it was the best and the brightest. You said, you know what, America will be better off if we have more government programs. If we spend more money, we're going to have a better country. And the people were unhappy about that and said, by the way, your numbers don't add up. Well, let's just say people would never get invited to this august group. I mean, these are people with funny hats going to rallies and saying we're spending too much money. So you're right. You have a huge elitist populist split on this. It is interesting to me. No, my guess is most wealthy people went along with the elites. Good.
Thank you very much. We do appreciate your coming. We're a little over time here. Thank you.
Thank you.
We always give our guests something to remember the club by.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's wonderful. And we hope to see many of you here again on Wednesday. Thank you for coming.
And I'm here to sign the books, too.
Absolutely. Don't forget your books to everybody else.